At KPMG, our people make the difference. It's not just something we say, it's what we do. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG, make the difference.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to another episode of the Forever Mighty podcast. As you can tell, it is just me, Steven, today. I will be talking today with Chris Watkins. You might know him from Twitter as Yolo Pinato or DJ Bodega Cat. Unfortunately for us, Chris is a Blackhawks fan, but that we won't hold against him. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, I'm doing good, man. Just, you know, weather's picking up, and, you know, things are starting to open back up and stuff. So you know, cannot complain too much on my end.
You're getting out of that Joe Kim Noah weather?
Yeah. You know, a little bit. Why would anybody go to Cleveland weather? You know, we're almost out of that stage. So yeah. But yeah, no, things are looking like they're on the upswing.
Good. So I kind of, just to kind of start, I kind of became aware of you, as weird as I guess that is to say, a couple of years ago. I think you had built a model that tried to determine trade value.
Yeah.
How did you get into hockey and analytics specifically, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, so the hockey piece was, you know, when I was much younger, back in the 32-bit era of gaming, there used to be this thing called demo disc that used to come with the console that you would buy. So I bought a PlayStation 1, I want to say 96 or 97, and, you know, I begged my parents to get it. They got it and then didn't realize the investment that it was required to actually get the game up and running. So they got me the console, but didn't give me the games because they saw they were like $50, $60 each. And they're like, no,
yeah,
that's a bridge too far. So basically it was just all I had was a demo disc. On there was like NHL, I want to say 97, whatever year the Panthers and the Avalanche were playing in the, finals. And so that's basically just all I played off of that. Just like 5 minutes. That was it. You only could pick the Panthers. You know? and so, yeah, you know, it was like, and so that was my first introduction to hockey. I seen it on SportsCenter, you know, back when everyone watched SportsCenter. I'd seen it, but it was only in highlights and plays. So I didn't really understand any of the nuances of the game. Only saw goals and hits. So that's how I thought the game was played for, you know, almost a decade. And then when I got a little bit older, moved down to Atlanta for school, started to watch the Thrashers, and then got back into the video games. And that's when I started to get into you know, the trades and sort of the roster construction, all of that stuff, better understanding sort of how that process works. And so that just sort of led to me being more interested in sort of following up on that and diving more into the analytics piece, like who would be the players that you would trade, who plays best with each other. These were things that were represented in the video game world, but not necessarily so in the, you know, in the actual hockey discussion sphere. And so just over time that evolved into more nuanced discussions about, you know, who are the best players, what actually makes someone the best player, what is the best players, set of players to actually construct a winning hockey team and stuff. And so, you know, this coincided obviously with the Blackhawks doing very well. but there was, you know, there was also, you know, some sort of, you know, more behind the scenes stuff outside of, you know, just drafting Taze and Kane, you know, 1 and 3 in back to back years. That led to them being a super successful franchise in that time period. So how do you sort of understand the sort of other, you know, 21 players on the ice and so on and so forth? And so that just sort of led to a longer term fascination with the analytics piece. And, you know, it's been like that ever since.
Okay. If you don't mind my asking, how old are you?
34.
Okay. So you're only a couple years older than me. I'm 31.
Okay. Yeah.
So you've been kind of the same for, some extent, some of the same, what do you call it? Kind of like big hockey moments that I do.
Right.
Yeah. I remember, it's funny. I remember when I really got like back into the league as a whole was the Hawks Flyers, finals. And I just remember watching those whole playoffs and they were great.
Right.
And oh, that was a blast. I'm sad to say I was definitely rooting for the Flyers. As a Ducks fan, my loyalty was to Chris Pronger.
Sure, of course.
But still, so one of the things that you talk about, I think, is really interesting as far as people's kind of hesitancy or pushback or whatever about analytics is, you made a point that I hadn't thought about as far as basketball, about how analytics basketball is just 2K ball.
Right.
And the thing I wonder about that is it kind of ties into something else you said that I saw, which is that McDavid is basically James Harden. And so I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you, because I think, you know, James Harden for me is maybe the least enjoyable super player I've ever seen. I have absolutely no interest in watching James Harden play basketball, but he is objectively incredible.
Right.
You know, and it's funny, I think, how much the nuances or little things change it, because like I'm a Chris Paul fan. Him and Chris Paul are both pound the rock kind of guys, but the difference is more often than not, Chris Paul leads to a pass where, you know, James Harden's kind of, I don't know, 50-50, 60-40. What does 2K ball look like in hockey? Is there a version of that, or is it more just an analogy to appreciate analytics and the way that it gets overthought?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, the exact quote I had was, Connor McDavid is James Harden with Kyrie Irving highlights, to your exact point, in terms of recognizing that Connor McDavid is objectively a fascinating player to watch and see, you know, on a game-to-game basis in a way that James Harden is not, but in the way that they both sort of affect the game as Charles Barkley said about James Harden, you know, possibly the best, you know, offensive player in NBA history. And this is a guy who, you know, used to be best friends with Michael Jordan and went head to head with him mm-hmm. in the finals and, you know, knows his game inside and out and has said James Harden is potentially better than him on offense. The difference between him and Michael Jordan, obviously, is that Michael Jordan was also an all-world defender.
Right.
But James Harden is objectively not. So
yeah. Controversial so take.
So it bounces out. So, you know, but to your question about, you know, what does 2K ball look like? So I think, you know, it's a little bit harder because the 2K, you know, to get into the sort of nuances of it, you know, there's the meta game of 2K, which has been honed over the years. You know how there's sort of professional 2K leagues and all that stuff right. like that. Or people have been playing, you know, I've been playing 2K religiously. You know, I've probably put in tens of thousands of hours of playing 2K. I used to be like number four in the world. Like when 2K9 came out, like that. So there's a very established meta game, but at the essence, it was always three pointers and dunks. Mm-hmm. You didn't go for the two pointers. One, because it was a very hard thing to do in 2K, and then two, like you just optimize your team and you optimize your roster to get you those things. So for me, for example, I always have a team full of shooters that can score a lot, guys that can dunk really well, and guys that block shots. Mm-hmm. Like I don't pay attention to passing. I don't pay attention to rebounding. I don't pay attention to even like perimeter defense or steals or anything like that. Like if you beat my guy off the dribble, like I know how to play well enough to sort of make that difficult for you. But if you can get past my guy, I have five guys at the rim that are going to block your shot. And, you're not and so you're not scoring in that instance. And then I'm getting 3 points on the other end. So you're going for 2 points and it's very hard for you to get those 2 points. And I'm getting 3 points on the other end. And by the law of averages, I'm just going to win that exchange,
you know, right,
60-70% of the time. And so it's funny now that you see that the Milwaukee Bucks have been the most recent manifestation of that, where they are like, we're giving you as many 3-pointers as you want, but you're mm-hmm. never scoring at the rim because we have a bunch of shot blockers. And now the other end, we have a guy, Giannis, that is going to get us a dunk every single time. And then if he doesn't get a dunk, we have a whole bunch of guys that will shoot us threes. And so, you know, and it's like, oh, this innovative new strategy that everyone is doing. I'm like, guys, people have literally been doing this for 15, 20 years. Like, this is nothing new. And to the point where if you go back and watch the All-Star games, for example, or the rookie sophomore games, you know, people where it's all dunks and three-pointers and no defense, that's what they say. Oh, these are video game settings. This is realistic competition, all that stuff like that. So basically all that is saying that these strategies have existed in some capacity in the minds of people who are sort of super fans. For hockey, it's a little bit different. The only things I've seen are, and we're starting to see it more, is like, obviously, you don't need grit. And
we're going to get into that.
Well, yeah. You don't need grit and plotting defensemen to play well, you know, in a hockey video game. And actually, it's the opposite. A majority of the guys I've seen, you know, they have all five of the players that can carry the puck off the ice, get it up there, you know, they bring it back and regroup mm-hmm. and stuff, which is only something you really only see in the overtimes in 3-on-3. They do that at 5-on-5. You know, it's quick passing. It's a lot more deking. And so, you know, the closest manifestations you'll see of it, McDavid is one, but I think the guys that I think are most representative of that are Matt Barzal and Kirill Kaprizov. We're guys who just hold on to the puck. Like
mm-hmm.
you'll see in the video game setting, like a guy will just hold on to a puck with one player for, you know, 20 or 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And hockey that in the NHL that never happens, where one guy just sort of holds on to the puck in the James Harden style and just skates around and then passes it when someone comes open. That's not normally how it happens. And so there's a lot more egalitarianism in terms of the hockey style offense, but that's not how they do it. Yeah, I'm actually curious to see if people will go more towards that, like, hey, this one person is going to bring in the puck and do most of the work. You all just get into the right spots and just get it back to that one person over and over again in that very James Harden model. So I can see that playing out. I mean, the other thing is, like, banning slap shots. Like, just don't do that. You know, go for the, you know, the backdoor passes, plays behind the net, which has been something that, you know, people like Ryan Simpson have advocated for. So there's a lot of stuff to it. But to me, the biggest things are having more skill and then maximizing that skill by, like, just giving those people the puck as much as possible.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say it that way, because I think you know, every year the draft comes around and, you know, half the league fan base decides that they're going to care about prospects very, very much for, you know, 6 weeks. And one of the things, you know, you see in like clips and stuff is you see a lot of the high end guys doing exactly what you're talking about, which is they just hold on to the puck and they just circle the offensive zone over and over waiting. And then, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a give and go here.
What?
But usually it really is that James Harden thing where they get it to a spot, pass it to somebody, and then that person has, you know, essentially a tap in.
Correct.
And it's interesting to hear you say it that way because I really was trying to think about it today. I was like, what does that look like? What does 2K ball look like in hockey? Because, you know, I think the one thing, the advantage that basketball has is that it is very easy to see and explain why a dunk and a three-pointer are good. In hockey, you know, I think we could all say like, oh yeah, shots from the slot, slap shots, you know, because that's kind of the other thing that I think about a lot is like one-timers are right. Such a big part of hockey video games that it's almost a joke.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just, I think it's really interesting that it's really just that hyper puck possession style where you just have one guy do it and everybody else just kind of try to move around. And in that mold, is that kind of one of the reasons you're a fan of the four forwards, 1D?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just basically, and we're starting to see this permeate across the board in other sports as well, where, you know, football sort of secretly had it. You know, the fullback is basically a non-existent position, you know, at this point. Sad. Yeah, you know, you don't have the I formation and, you know, two right. Running backs. You do have blocking tight ends and stuff, and that has come in vogue. But, you know, you've gotten rid of like less skilled players, which has evolved, interestingly enough, where it has gotten to the point where it's like, okay, well, guys who might have subsisted off of not having skill. Like, I have no idea what Dennis Rodman was doing his entire career. Like, I don't know how you play in the league 18, 20 years and don't develop a jump shot. Like, that is just something that wouldn't suffice today. And so, like, I don't know what he was doing during, like, what does practice with Dennis Rodman consist of? Like, he wasn't, like, doing post-ups. He wasn't doing jump shots. Like, I have no idea what he was doing. So, that's just, like, the skill development is just much more refined than it was, you know, 20 years ago. So, so the guys who were the big uglies, or as they used to be called, are not that anymore. Even a guy like, you know, Tyler Myers and, you know, Rasmus Ristolainen, you know, Zdeno Chara, like the really, really big guys, you know, they have probably much more, they have the skill that will probably, you know, in the top 10% of the league in the 1980s.
Right.
But, you know, they also have the size to go with it. So it's interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, I think like just, the reason why I'm a big advocate for four forwards and one defenseman is because forwards are sort of held to a more objective standard. It's still not great, but they're held to a more objective standard of like you're only going to play if you are better than, you know, the other, you know, 10 guys on the roster. Versus defenseman is, you know, well, we just needed a body. Reese Jessup, former, you know, scout for the Florida Panthers, said last night, hey, create a scouting report about a player that doesn't reference their size or handedness. Like, okay, you know, 90% of the time,
yeah,
you know, oh yeah, they're traded for Matthias Ekholm, you know, right shot D, you know, 6'4", plays
right,
you know, 1 minute a night. Like, that tells me nothing about their effectiveness, about how they would add to the team, how they fit in with the other players. That's just a list of characteristics. You might as well say, like, blonde hair, you know, likes long walks on the beach, all that stuff like that. That has nothing to do with whether or not they'll help me win a hockey game. And so I think that's where the 4-4s comes into play. I think people think I don't believe that defensemen have any value. I'm like, no, good defense. Dougie Hamilton is my favorite player. Like, good defensemen have value. The problem is that most of the defensemen aren't good, and we treat them like they are, and that's where it creates issues.
That's interesting, because, like, I've said this before. Listeners will know that this is just one of those things for me. Like, I joke that I have Brian Burke brain. Like, I really am, like, Rob Niedermeyer and guys like that, who, you know, who have in the global talent pool elite skill, but within the context of the NHL are really, you know, seventh and eighth men kind of basketball right. equivalent and stuff like that. Like, those are the kind of guys that, like, I love. Like, right now, like, with the Ducks, like, Josh Manson's one of my favorite players right. because he's a shutdown guy. He does that kind of, you know, quote-unquote old-school stuff. You know, like, I want, like, the moment I fell in love with him as a player was when he beat the shit out of Mark Giordano, which right. just tickled me to death. So it's one of those things where I try to check my biases and things like that. You know, I know for a long time there's been issues with guys' size, and now we're seeing, you know, guys like Braden Point be successful. And I think it's interesting to, you know, you look at Johnny Gaudreau or you look at Braden Point, you're looking at, even going back Martin St. Louis, and you're looking at elite skill players right. who are able to succeed at that size. But I think guys like Nathan Gerbe or Gerbe or however you say his yeah. last name is really interesting to me because he's a third liner and I think he's 4.5 feet tall.
Right.
And so the idea that he has found a place for himself in the league, I think, given how heavy GMs, you know, lean into size and grit or toughness and all these kinds of things that can be a little nebulous or overly simplistic, I think is really interesting. Let's see.
I mean, just quickly to that point, I mean, even for me, like, I grew up playing basketball, basically my whole life. And, you know, with that comes a sort of, you know, ability to understand and see things that just come naturally. You know, I can watch a 5-minute game, not have any idea who the players are, and just watch for 5 minutes and be able to pick up, like, okay, I have a pretty good idea who's good. And an interesting sort of like Twitter challenge that comes up often is if you didn't have points or goals or whatever, you're watching like the KHL or something like that, you had no idea who the teams were, and you didn't have points or goals, how would you know who the best player on the ice is?
Right.
And I think, you know, for me at least, objectively, it's very difficult to do for hockey because, you know, there's so much going on, and so much what is done is a sort of process thing. Even going back to the video games, to me, like, you know, when I play the NHL video game series, it's a process. You know, I'm trying to get the puck in deep. Okay, great. You know, I'm trying to get the puck into my own zone. I'm trying to generate a good shot on net. You know, I'm trying not to, you know, shoot a slap shot. You know, no hope for a slap shot from the blue line. I'm trying to prevent the other team from getting it in, and just repeat that process endlessly, and then hopefully do that, I will create more goals than the other team.
Right.
Versus 2K, you know, as I said, I want to have, you know, I want to block all the shots at the rim, and then I want to shoot as many threes as possible. But within that, okay, what lineups do I put out? You know, let me call a timeout. Let me switch out this player for this player. You know, oh, this player's getting tired. Should I play him another 5 minutes, or should I bring somebody else out so I have him, like, left over for the game? And so, to me, it's less about execution and more about the strategy plus the execution. And I think it's the same thing with a hockey game, where it's like me seeing a Sidney Crosby. Obviously, yes, he has. I think Sidney Crosby's been underrated with the emergence of Connor McDavid, because Sidney Crosby's never necessarily, you know, captured the imagination, even like an Ovechkin did,
right.
or even like a Connor McDavid obviously has. But the things he does are just 5% better than everybody else every single second that he's on the ice. And so that accumulates to, you look at all of his underlying stats, he's just so much better than everybody else, you know, at the end of the season. But it's hard to recognize, you know, on a game by game or highlight by highlight basis. And I think that is one of the issues that people have with just understanding what's going on in the game of hockey.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, one of the things I've noticed as I've tried to go back a little bit and look at older players and do all sorts of dumb roster games and stuff like that, right. is you get to a certain point and you start to see ice time doesn't exist. And right. I think traditionally that is as close as a way as we can get without seeing the games, getting an idea of who the better players were back then. But that's inherently flawed, because you have to factor in the fact that the coach has his own preferences. And anybody who's watched a hockey game or watched anything any sport, they you will see coaches make bad decisions. You know it's going to happen, and you're going to be like, okay, don't do this. And then they're like, yeah, I'm going to bring this guy in. And you're like, right, but he's not good. But he has your trust and things like that. And so I think it's really interesting. Like, one of the things that I kind of, I'd be curious to know what you think about this, like, as I get frustrated with, is when people say, like, Joe Thornton should win the Selke because he keeps the puck in the other end the entire game. And I think that's ridiculous to me, because Selke is for playing defense. And philosophically, tactically, I can appreciate the best way to prevent goals is to have the puck in the other end as much as possible. And I think that, again, philosophically, I think that makes sense. But I think when you say what makes someone a good defender, defense is the act of stopping. And if you have the puck, you're not stopping anything. And so
right.
I think the way in which we're trying to kind of understand all the different factors that go on in a single game and that lead to decisions and stuff like that is it's really in its earliest stages right now, I guess is a good way to say it, as far as information that we have that we can put into statistical models and things like that.
But yeah. So when it comes to the Selke, you know, I try not to think too much about the Selke. But to your point, there is hockey's unique in that, you know, in football, most players don't play offense and defense unless you're Deion Sanders. Mm-hmm. You know, in baseball, you know, baseball, basketball, there's a set amount of possessions that you're given. There's a set amount of defense that you're going to play in a given game, no matter what. And so, therefore, it's easier to sort of recognize that. But when it comes to the Selke, you know, oftentimes it is like the best guy who's putting up over 70 points. The best of a guy putting up 70 points. But going back to the early point that you were making, like, I think the reason why you sort of see that of sort of like the guys who have some clear and inherent weaknesses sort of get away hockey and coaches be able to get away with making decisions like that is that if you're in the NBA game and you know, coaches loves this rugged guy who's, you know, 6'7" and is diving all over. Basically, if you had Dennis Rodman playing in today's NBA, and coaches just love him and they play him, or an inferior version of Dennis Rodman, the difference is teams and coaches and players in particular are so ruthless that guy would not get guarded whatsoever. So they're going to leave that guy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so there was a big debate, for example, Draymond Green talking about defense. Draymond Green called himself the best defender in history, and then Tony Allen, who played for the Memphis Grizzlies, was another great defender, you know, said, oh, I didn't, you know, just back and forth around who's really the greatest defender of all time. And, you know, Draymond Green basically said, as great of a defender that you were, we actually used your lack of ability to shoot against you and play 4-on-5 against your team, and that's how we beat you. And he called him out.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah. And so basically you're saying, like, even as good as you are at one end of the court, we use that, your inability to affect the other side of the court against you. It single-handedly used you to affect your team. And the same thing on defense. If you're bad on defense in the NBA, LeBron James will find you and will put you in a pick and roll and will get you to guard him even if you don't want to, even if this game doesn't call for it, until the coach takes you out the game. And there's not a ruthless sort of attitude in the NHL where it's like, I'm going to take advantage of this tactical mistake of a coach, and therefore a coach can say, I'm going to put out this fourth liner on the first line to inject some grit and energy, and then, you know, if the fourth liner scores, great, well, that was a great tactical decision. And if not, the coach doesn't face any repercussions for that. So coaches can make these bad decisions on a regular recurring basis because there's no really consequences that are easy to see. You'll see them over the long term of the season. But you know, sort of held back because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and the point you made earlier about slap shots, I almost wonder if the Tony Allen version of that is just not pressing the point. But, you know, it's just interesting to me because I think there is something to be said for don't guard slap shots from the point. But then it becomes about, you know, trying to make sure you're clearing lanes so the goalie can see because you don't want to get a tip and things like that. And so I just think it's a really interesting because, like, Tony Allen is, you know, he was an incredible on-ball defender, help defender, all that stuff. But, you know, he couldn't throw a rock in the ocean. And I think, so I was turning into an NBA thing, but it's just interesting because I think Tony Allen shows how good you have to be at defense to make the fact that offensively you are limited justifiable. And like, I think of someone like Patrick Laine, you know, or like comparing, like, so for Ducks fans, like one of the things that we talk about all the time is like Daniel Sprong, who was like, we got him from Pittsburgh in the Pedersen trade, and then he went to Washington. He's got like 5 goals this year, and it's very exciting for him. And it was always very frustrating for a lot of fans because he had a great shot, and we were expecting him to hopefully develop into an offensive player, but he wasn't doing enough in the rest of the game to like get a coach to trust him. And I think it's interesting that there's like a tipping point where it's like, if you don't want to do anything else, you need to be able to hit 40 goals. If you can hit 40 goals, they'll let the fact that you don't do anything else slide. But that tipping point doesn't exist. And I think, you know, like with roster construction, one of the things that's really interesting is GMs and coaches seem to naturally come back to the idea of going with guys that they can trust.
Right.
And I wonder if you think that that skews towards the bottom of the lineup. Because it feels like when they're doing this, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to put my third line out there or my fourth line out there because they're going to do exactly what I asked them to do, as opposed to some level of risk when you do get skill players out there who are trying to be creative and trying to make things happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's, to me, that's exactly it. And I understand it. Like, I admittedly, anytime I'm playing my NHL 21 via GM mode, and I will play a game and make some costly turnover by being too aggressive with the puck, and it inevitably leads to a goal, or I get too aggressive with a stick check, and then I'm on a power play, and then I'm down 3-1. And the difference is, you know, when I'm playing 2K, you know, I can make a mistake, and okay, I give up 2 points, but I can make that over the course of a game.
Yeah.
Versus where a mistake is amplified, particularly if it leads to a goal. And so, from a just a objective standpoint, or not even an objective standpoint, but just from a, you know, risk mitigation standpoint, from a coach's perspective, I would much rather have a guy who's, I'd much rather have death by 1,000 cuts than, you know, self-inflicted, you know, gunshot wound or something like that. Not to get graphic on that, but
it's Ducks hockey. Nothing you're saying is worse than what we've watched this year.
Well, yeah. And so from a coach's perspective, and across all sports, it's, you know, a repeated notion that coaches have the most impact on the defensive end, where you can establish some structure, you can establish the abilities and sort of put people in positions to succeed. So even an individual defender can be maximized. Someone who's not a good individual defender can be maximized in a good structure and system. The New York Knicks are a perfect example this year, who have Tom Thibodeau, you know, a good defensive coach, coming in and instilling good defensive structure in a way that Barry Trotz is doing for the Islanders, in theory. I still have questions about it, but in theory, that's what's happening there. The problem is, to your exact point, though, is that the best players are doing things that are outside the structure of the sport, and they break the structure. And so this is what we talk about, Matt Barzal, Kirill Kaprizov. It's just like, I'm going to do things that are outside of the structure of the sport. Connor McDavid is going to break your defensive structure, and no coach can do that. And it's very difficult for coaches to take credit for that. And so when things go bad, they also can't, they're being forced to take blame for something they really don't have the control over. And so in that situation, it's like, well, I'd much rather say, like, we dumped the puck in, we did everything we were supposed to, and if we fails, what's our lack of execution versus our lack of strategy? And so I think that's where it's just risk mitigation. There's only 31 jobs in the NHL. You know, most coaches maybe get hired on, you know, over under 1.5 times. And so they're just looking at, well, what is going to make me look good in the interim? Letting my players run hog wild and maximizing their skill set, or slowing down the game so then that way when they win, John Tortorella, I can take all the credit for it. And then when they lose, well, I can just say that they didn't do what I told them to do. So I think that's ultimately what drives it. But you do get exposed to a certain extent. The problem is, I actually don't know you know, even unlike basketball, I really don't know where a hockey coach can instill that positive momentum. I know where they can instill negative momentum in terms of playing time and, you know, sort of more conservative strategies. But I've argued that hockey is more of a GM-driven game where you need to have the right roster construction, the right depth, the right allocation of the cap and sort of the right stars in place. And then the coach really doesn't matter at that point. All the coach can do is mess it up. And so that,
yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, exactly what you're talking about, where it seems like the best thing a coach can do is let you play, is teach you, help you play defense, give you a system, and then let the offense kind of go wild. And I'm pretty sure that's kind of what George Karl's whole thing was, which is if you do what I ask you on defense, you can do whatever you want at the other end, you know, and guys like Melo and J.R. Smith and Ty Lawson and these kinds of players have had a good deal of success under him as far as offensively producing, and the teams were competent defensively and things like that. And it's interesting because I think you're I think you're dead on when you say that it does feel like the most a coach can do in hockey is hurt the team by making kind of galaxy brain personnel decisions. And you know, like Dallas Eakin starting Derek Grant to go out there against the MacKinnon line.
Right.
And exactly to your point, technically, the one of the games they did it, MacKinnon didn't score a goal. But, you know, shooting percent is 10% and nobody reaches a goal a game. So how much did it work and how much was it just the odds being in your favor?
Correct.
And, you know, I think the other part of this that's really interesting to me is the way in which kind of goaltending plays into this, because we have seen bad goalies have a good year and be incredibly successful more times, I think, than we have seen a great goalie have an outsized impact. You know, last year, Hellebuck only got them so far. The year before that, Gibson only got them so far. You know, Henrik Lundqvist tried to do it a few times. Like, we have this history of really good goalies failing to lift their team forward, and it makes me wonder if the best thing you can do is just have goalies on the smallest contracts you can find, bring guys in for 2 or 3 years, and then just move them out and start using that cap to increase your goals or things like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure you probably saw I was not a big fan of the Thatcher Demko extension, and not because I don't think Thatcher Demko is, you know, and if you played NHL 17 or anything like that when he was just a prospect, you know, he turns into, you know, like a 7-time Vezina winner every simulation that you run. So, you know, I've been a big fan of his from the beginning as a result of that. But the problem is, to your exact point, you know, that's a lot of money to top in goaltending. And you see even John Gibson this year, who hasn't played spectacularly well. You know, goaltending is very fickle. If you happen to land up on a great goaltender, you know, that's great. But, you know, as I said to Canucks fans, I was like, look at Braden Hopi, who for 3 or 4 years was objectively one of the best goalies in the league. And then just the bottom fell out of nowhere. And even the year that they won, he won primarily as Grubauer's backup, and then came in and took over in the playoffs and sort of got them in the right mix. But even the same thing with Fleury and not Tristan Jarry,
Matt Murray.
Yeah. So, you know, same thing with Fleury. Fleury, you know, for years had been maligned as the reason why the Penguins lost so many times in the playoffs, and now Matt Murray comes in and sort of pushes, you know, either pushes Fleury to a different level of play, or, you know, they just had other options to go to other than Fleury and could just go with a hot hand. And so in that situation, it's like, okay, we're going to go with that. And to your point, I've said it multiple times, it actually got back and forth with Matt Cain, who's with the Devils about this, where basically when we talk about PDO, your shooting percentage, your save percentage, almost inversely proportional. Like, you know, one goes up, the other one goes down, because you can only afford to really pay for one. You know, you pay for a shooting percentage to go up. You know, you pay for your shooters, so on and so forth. That means your defense is likely not going to be as good.
Right.
And in theory, your goalie, you can't afford a goalie, or you can go all in and, you know, pay for defense, pay for a great goalie, but then you're not likely going to have the finishing talent to sort of get there. And it's very difficult to sort of thread that needle. So my argument has been, yeah, the smart teams go all in on, you know, creating the best team that they can from their skaters. And then if you find a great goalie, great. And then if that great goalie happens to have a bad season, well, you can sort of work around it, although the Hurricanes will sort of argue that fact. But you just do it long enough, and then once you finally hit on that hot goaltender, well, then you're sort of really good to go. So, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why Carey Price, him, or Lundqvist. I'm trying to remember the last guy who won a Vezina and a Stanley Cup in the same year. It's not happening very often.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, no, that's it. It's funny. I was thinking about it right now, and I think most fans could think of, you know, 10 bad goalie contracts before they could think of 5 good goalie contracts.
Right.
They might be able, like, you know, you could pick 5 good goalies, but the goalie and the contract, the value system is so different. You know, I don't care how good Carey Price is, spending $10.5 million on him is a disaster. Like,
right.
You can just do so much more with that money, you know, and then it's funny to watch teams kind of have, like, live that out and then shoot themselves in the foot, like the Jordan right. Binnington thing. There was no reason. There's no reason they should have committed to Jordan Binnington for another 5 years. But he's the guy that won him the cup. And so, you know, like, now all of a sudden they're committed to him. And I don't know that I want Jordan Binnington for 5 weeks. Like,
right.
So now you have this thing, and it's funny too, because it's like they had the whole Jake Allen and Brian Elliott, and then they brought in Ryan Miller and Martin Brodeur, and like they brought all of these guys through trying to find it, and they were bringing all these guys of some level of pedigree. I guess you could quibble a little with Brian Elliott, but then this dude comes up from the AHL, plays well, and as their goaltending improves, some of their stars start to finish, and now we know how that ends, and it ends, you know, Ryan O'Reilly wins the Selke and they get the Stanley Cup and all that, and Jordan Binnington's the hero. But the right. truth of it is he just played adequate goaltending behind a really good team.
Right.
And so I just think the opportunity cost of goaltending is so interesting, because, you know, it's one of the most important positions, but it's also the one that you should arguably invest the least in, because it's so fickle.
There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy, because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post, so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWireSports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, when I looked at this, you know, and actually tried to formulate the trade sort of values for goaltenders, it was like basically impossible, because if you break down the contracts, and you can ask it involving, you know, Wild Twins about this as well, when you break down the contracts that goalies have gotten, you know, the most important variable is like previous starts or games played. Not necessarily the performance in those, but just saying enough other coaches have trusted you, I'm going to give, especially if you're signing a free agent, other coaches have trusted you in this position, I'm going to give you a bunch of money as a result. Jacob Markstrom is a perfect example. And so it's not based off of, say, you know, delta save percentage, you know, above average, X, Y, and Z, and that's also because of a lack of nuance in goaltending stats. But basically it gets to the point where, and Carter Hart is a interesting test case against my theory, that you almost just want to throw as many goals into the fire as possible. You want to start them as early as possible, because if they're actually a good goalie, you want to maximize their peak talent level as early as possible, because when you look at the aging curves for goalies, it actually starts much earlier than goalies that come into the league. You know, it's around 23-24, and that save percentage starts to go like progressively, you know, upward or downward. And so you almost have to like bring them in before you think they're ready and have a sample size to prove it. And then when you're paying for the contract, oftentimes you're paying for like, well, I have 5 years of proof that this guy's a good goalie.
Right.
Like, great. That's the 5 years that he's going to be a good goalie. You're paying for the after effects of that. But the time for him to be a good goalie is no longer exists anymore.
Yeah, it's almost like the, what is, I think it's 500 carries or something like that in the right. NFL. When you see that number for a running back, it's just let him right. be. I think DeMarco Murray hit it, and everybody was like, oh, don't sign that. And then I think he went to Tennessee or whatever. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, you talking about paying for past results, I really wonder, like, I feel like the first GM to invert essentially the wage scale for hockey what? Is going to win 20 cups in a row. Because if you can convince guys to, you know, take these big deal, like, I don't know that it's like a convince, but like, you know what I mean? Like, if you can create a system where you're paying your best players during their primes when they're young, and then starting to take that cap hit down on the back end as they age out, you can actually build a better team, and you can almost kind of work it as far as, you know, you've got these guys on ELCs coming up, which is so cheap that you can then let some of your older guys start to age out, and then hopefully you kind of create this cycle. But, you know, we've seen prospect development is so hit or miss. And, you know, it's hard to know, you know, like you had a thing about how that sending players down to the AHL is just really just confirmation bias. Because either you send him down and he fails and it's like, well, see, that's why we sent him down. He wasn't good. Or he goes down and he plays well and it's, oh, yeah, that's why we sent him down. So he could kind of, and I'm very much one of those people as far as I think it's good to let guys kind of have, like, not a purgatory, but almost like an opportunity to kind of acclimate before they get to the full game, because, like, the quality of play in the AHL is different than it is in the NHL. And, you know, if you can watch someone step in and do well, then they can step in and do well. And yet, it's hard to know if the end result is inevitable if you remove the middle part.
Yes. Yes and no. So a couple of things. So, yeah. So going back to your point about the inverting the cap structure. So I would actually argue, despite my vehement arguments the other way, I would argue that that's actually not the case, because we got a team like the Maple Leafs that actually did do that. And they tried to prioritize, or it was prioritized for them, that they were going to pay Marner, they were going to pay Matthews, and to a lesser extent, Nylander, for, you know, really their prime years coming off their ELC. That's what they did. And I think Matthews' contract in particular was, you know, still is an outlier in terms of being able to get maximum AAV with a minimum term for a guy coming off his RFA. I mean, I think that was great for Matthews, and kudos to his agent and whoever pulled that off. That's very NBA style. I know Austin definitely pays attention to the NBA, and so it probably is that where that idea formulated from. But that kind of screwed them over, and not because it was the wrong idea. The problem is not everyone else wasn't doing that, so everyone else was paying $6 or $7 million for their RFAs, and you're paying $10 million for your RFAs. And even though that is proper market value for them, if no one else is paying proper market value, then you're kind of overpaying. And so that, so you have to figure out other ways to sort of move the needle. When it comes to the development, I think the interesting part is, and Scott Powers from The Athletic, him and I talk quite a bit, and this is something we talk about, where one of the biggest issues in hockey is the outsourcing of development and outsourcing of skill development to other areas. Oh, we'll leave this guy in the OHL. Oh, we'll leave them, you know, going back to Quentin Byfield. Oh, we'll leave him in the AHL for a couple of years, you know, a year or two. Let him grow, develop. You know, let's avoid burning a year out the ELC. It's like, okay, but what explicitly are they doing there? You know, so in the NBA, if you send a number two pick down to the G League, which almost never happens,
right?
What explicitly are they doing there? Well, this guy has a lot of talent, but we want him to work on his jump shot, or we want him to learn how to run a pick and roll. So you'll run every single, you know, it's purely on development. So every single game, you're running that guy through 50 pick and rolls for him to get the pattern recognition to understand, oh, if I do this, this defender will come this way and I throw a pass out here, and they'll become better with it over time. Or they're working on a jump shot and they're getting up 1,000 shots a day, and eventually you'll start to see the numbers creep up. And I don't know explicitly what that is for the NHL. I don't know what, like, LA's doing for Quentin Byfield and saying, you're doing this 150 times every single day. So by the time you actually make it to the big roster, you are that much better with the skill than you would have been had you come in here from day one. I don't know what that is, and I don't think there's a structured, formulaic plan with clear milestones of success and failure to say you're on the right track or you're not for every prospect in the NHL pipeline. And so because of that, I'm like, they're just handing out the responsibility and just hoping that it works out, and then just send me up the guys that you are know for a fact are very good. I'm like, that's fine, but you are also missing a lot of guys by the wayside that could have been developed in the right system that you're just not investing the time and energy into. Like Trevor Zegras, like, yeah, we know he's good, but what are you doing with, you know, Sam Steele and Max Jones, or, you know, all the other guys in the pipeline to make them the best version of themselves, other than they just showed up ready to go at your doorstep?
Yeah, so let me ask you this. Do you think that the solution to that, as it were, is to have a heavier hand in dealing with the minor league team? Or is it just kind of maximizing training camp and rookie camp to see the guys that maybe you can bring in and develop them kind of along the way? Because, like, one of the things that I think is hard is, as much as there are playtime disparities between the fourth line and the first line, there are guys who, you know, everybody does play a fair amount, whereas there aren't really guys like in the NBA where, like, 13, 14, 15 guys are just DNP just because. Like, they just didn't get it. And so, like, I wonder how you kind of make up for that difference. And, like, one of the things I remember thinking about is, like, do you put your young players on the PK so they can just get that kind of experience on top of the fact that they're younger, they have all that energy, they've got something to prove, you know what I mean? And kind of use their actual skill with some of the mental and emotional stuff and maximize that, so then you can actually play them more at even strength and you're not running out guys like Nate Thompson or Derek Grant or, you know, guys who at 5-on-5 are a net negative, even if, you know, on a penalty kill, they're useful players.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't explicitly thought about it in that context, but yes, I think that is along the right lines of putting your players, particularly in a non-winning context. Like, you know, if you're the Avalanche, if you're, you know, Tampa Bay, you know, you're justified in putting talented guys on the third line and having them work their way up the roster because you already have, like, legitimate people in front of them that they shouldn't be displacing. And even the best version of the young player may not be better than the current version of that other player. And so in that situation, they shouldn't be displacing anybody. But to your point, like, having young players in those situations sort of forces them to do the things that they are uncomfortable with. You know, as I said many times, you know, when you're in the NBA, in NHL, when you're a particularly a forward, you know, every stop in your career prior to getting to the NHL, you were the best scorer on your team. You were the best player. You had the puck all the time. And how do you develop that role and figure out how to do things off, you know, off the puck? And you know, there's somebody that's better than you that's going to take a lion's share of that. So how do you, like, figure out what your identity is outside of that? That's one way of sort of forcing the narrative. I think the other part of it to your question about, like, is it more heavy-handed approach? I think it's either one of two things. So it's either one where, you know, a better, more comprehensive understanding of what the players are. You know, I got a little bit into it with a writer for the Rangers at the beginning of the year when they acquired Anthony Boteto. It's like, you Rangers acquired left-handed D Anthony Boteto, you know, from the Winnipeg Jets, who played 59 games last year. I'm like, you have no idea who this player is. And I'm like, And to be fair, I don't know who he is either. I've never watched Winnipeg Jets games to see Anthony Boteto play, which is fair. But as a result, you don't know what his strengths and weaknesses are and how he can be best utilized within the game. Even the Patrick Laine, you know, PLD trade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, hey, we traded for a PLD and we have this so much center depth, and now Winnipeg is going to be a Dark Horse Stanley Cup contender. It's like, okay. And then there was this perception that PLD was a great defensive player. I'm like, have you ever watched him play? Have you ever seen his skill set? Have you ever seen how he impacts the game? It's actually more on the offensive end than mm-hmm. the defensive end. So you're expecting a significant defensive upgrade by going from Line A to PLD. You're going to be sadly mistaken. And so as a result of that, same thing with even Line A. You know, what is it about his game that, you know, maximizes him in certain situations, not with others? Who are the best players that play with him? There's a lot more nuance that goes to that. It says, like, I'm just going to get a 40-goal scorer, and that's just automatically going to translate to another 40 goals for my team that
right.
was on somebody else's team. That's not how that works. He also was playing with great playmakers and great passers who do not exist on the Columbus Blue Jackets. And so as a result, you're not going to get the same impact and output unless you find either another context for his game or find the players that complement the best version of what he is right now. And so it's either doing that or you can do the other thing, which is like, we don't know anything about development or drafting. We're really bad at it. We're just going to invest as many resources as possible to get as many players in the system,
mm-hmm.
buy a bunch of ECHL teams. We're going to spend a whole bunch of money on scouts in Europe, which is, you know, as much as I crap on the Blackhawks, that's what they've done in Europe. They've literally just like invested everything into getting the guys underground in Europe. And every year they're bringing over a Dominik Kubalik, you know, Artemi Panarin,
mm-hmm.
a contributor out of Europe, just manifest out of nowhere. And I give them credit for that. Nothing else, but that is literally, I can say that is a positive for them.
I take it you're not very high on Team USA's chances now with Bowman being in charge?
It's hard for him to screw up because he can't sign the players' extensions well after their prime. He may over-index on older players who can't contribute, but he won't be done in by cap issues.
Yeah, I'm excited to see David Backes make the team over Jack yes. Hughes.
Yes, exactly.
That's funny. Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the things that is kind of hard to appreciate is the way in which players interact and the way in which those players, like, just on the ice. Like, I'm not even trying to get right. to the off-ice stuff, but, like, the way that players, like, fit together, like, puzzle pieces and stuff and, like, I think, you know, sometimes we have these very, and this is something I think that you've talked about a lot that I think is really interesting, is we have these hyper-rigid ideas of what a first line is and a top six and a middle six and a bottom, you know, a fourth line and yeah. top pair D and bottom pair D. And to your point earlier, it's like, well, the Ducks are just going to put out Jacob Larson and Ben Hutton as the bottom pair just because they can. Like, those are the two guys that they have, and they're out there, and it's fine enough for now. Instead of, like, trying to, like, balance it out and make four... Like, I wonder if two A lines and two C lines is better than four B lines. And I don't know what teams have tried it, so there's no way to go back and see, like, which teams have had success other than... You know, you look at Tampa and how stacked that roster is. And then some of those guys aren't, you know, I don't think Yanni Gourde or Cedric Paquette, they're like top six guys elsewhere, but they have a relative skill level to the role that they're being asked that is above. And so they're able to find success in the system and in the context of that team.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, so a good example is Colorado, and gone back and forth with multiple people on this. What makes Colorado, like, this year so good, and especially the past couple of years. And, you know, one of the things I'll give them credit for, at least, you know, by my data, is that, like, they don't have any, you know, on their back end, for example, they don't have any slow skaters. So let's, you know, strip out their skill set, X, Y, and Z, and just only focus on skating. Just the pure fact that they have six above average skaters on every single, you know, defensive pairing allows them to do a lot more as an overall team, because that is never going to be a weakness for them. They're always going to be able to get the puck out of their own zone, no matter who's on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps unlock the forwards. And I think one of the underrated parts, you know, this is like going back to Jack Eichel versus like Austin Matthews, even Connor McDavid at the beginning of their career, was like, oh yeah, you know, there was a back and forth debate that, you know, Eichel was potentially in the same stratosphere as Connor McDavid. And, you know, how would you ever think that? And one of the things I argued was that because the Sabres defenders were so bad at that point in time that, you know, Buffalo was only getting 43% of the shot share. If you look at of those shots that they were actually able to get on the net when Jack Eichel was involved with them, they did really well.
Right.
But because they never get to shoot, because they never get the puck, you can't really see that. So the underlying numbers are always suppressed. And so, you know, it's the same thing in basketball where it's like, you know, they are definitely player types that work. For example, you have, you know, a Chris Paul type point guard, and a Tyson Chandler or a guy that can, you know, score off of alley oops all the time. Well, Chris Paul is an amazing passer and can get the ball to them. But the difference between Chris Paul and a Lonzo Ball or something like that is that Chris Paul, even if that team is like, okay, well, we're going to stand everybody near the rim and prevent an easy dunk, Chris Paul can make enough jump shots on his own where that's not a viable strategy. You have to also go out and guard him. And so now you're sort of left at you know, a decision-making process. Do I guard the jump shot or do I guard the dunk at the rim? And between both of those, like, those combinations are normally the best in the league on offense. What does that look like in the NHL? I still don't think people have a full understanding of that. I have some speculation and ideas, but when it comes to roster construction, the thought process should be, if I can find that particular perfect combination for less than the sum of the two parts, then that is where I can invest that money and resources elsewhere on my roster. And then that's when I start to create a competitive advantage that nobody else has.
But yeah, I think the thing that's interesting, right, is Chris Paul is able to make DeAndre Jordan this seemingly elite finisher and all these things. And that's true because, you know, he's 6'10" and he's long and he's springy. And so he's able to physically do certain things. But the thing is he's getting all these perfect passes.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, if the closest to that in hockey is kind of the ongoing joke that the best players to play with Sidney Crosby are nobodies. Like,
correct.
They bring in Phil Kessel and they're like, finally, we got a sniper. And he's like, yeah, but what if I just played with Brian Rust the whole time?
Right.
And you're like, okay. And so I wonder if to your point, like, that's kind of where those margins are that people or organizations need to start trying to exploit is finding those players that have a skill set that fit with their stars instead of, you know, trying. It's weird because you don't want to say not to bring in high-end talent, but in a hard cap league, you have to weigh the opportunity cost and you have to figure out how to maximize some of those opportunities. And so I don't know if it's just, you know, nobody who's not a star doesn't get longer than a 3-year contract.
Right. Although I would argue, and this is probably the biggest deviation I have with the general, even analytics community, is that, I mean, nobody that's not a star, that's not that's not coming off the RFA should get longer than a 3-year contract. Because even with the stars, so Artemi Panarin has been sort of a sore point for me in terms of roster construction, because I'm like, Artemi Panarin is a great, amazing player, no doubt. He makes zero sense on where the Rangers are as a roster.
Yeah.
You have years of Artemi playing at a heart level candidate, at a heart candidate level player, and they have nothing to show for it. They, in terms of actual, like, on ice success, there's been in sixth place the past few years in their division. And so the hope would be, well, once these young guys, Lafreniere's and the, you know, Adam Fox to me is already an amazing player, but to me he's also going to be who he's going to be. I don't really see him going much higher than one of the best defensemen in the league. That's already a lofty perch. You know, Shesterkin is already one of the best young goalies in the league. I don't know how you get much better than that. And you still are sort of struggling as a team overall. And so, you know, the argument I made against that was like, you don't sign that contract for a 7-year contract. So if you believe in that, you sign it for a 4-year contract, pay more AAV or something like that. But coaches and GMs in particular are so risk averse that it's like, okay, well, we got this great player. We have our own player that's locked up for long term. you know, take us into our 30s, and he'll be the one that defeats the aging curve, and like never happens. So
yeah,
in that instance, how do you? And so, you know, it may sound contradictory. I said, don't pay your young players a whole bunch of money like Austin Matthews. Don't pay your old players a whole bunch of money like, you know, Artemi Panarin. Where do you pay the players? And I think it comes into the fact that if you can find that sort of perfect mix, either like we're gonna go all in on players under the age of certain age, and obviously you need some presence in the locker room. Keep people from, you know, just throwing wild frat parties every day. or, you know, you sort of do the veterans and expendables route. Like, you know, Ryan Getzlaf, for example, I think his contract is up next year.
Mm-hmm.
And is he an $8 million a year player? Absolutely not. But if you can get him for $1.5 or $2 million, you know, there might be something there. And so how do you sort of balance that out of young players who are sort of hitting their prime plus older guys who are a little bit past, you know, long in the tooth, but still have something to contribute in the right role? If you can sort of do that and sort of hit that happy medium, while also making sure that everyone is at a value contract, you know, Carolina is going to be an interesting example of this. Like, I think they have no bad contracts on the roster, probably except Brady Shea. But Dougie Hamilton is going to be an interesting example. Dougie Hamilton is my favorite player in the world, probably of all time. But I don't want to sign him to an 8-year contract at $9 million a year or whatever, because he's not going to be that player. He might not even be that player anymore right now. And so that's where you sort of run into those issues of just trying to figure out, like, yes, we're paying for stars, but to what extent? Are you paying for the name brand on the back? Are you paying for what they're going to do on the ice?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think it was Reese the other day. I think the two of you were kind of, I don't know, Twitter's weird and it doesn't really make sense as far as having conversations. But I think I saw him talking about kind of the way you want your waves to line up as far as your waves of talent. And I think one of the things that's so interesting to me is it really is trying to perfectly thread a needle, because you like you said, you need to have some of those guys who are a little bit older to supplement the younger guys who are coming into it. But if those younger guys aren't base level good enough to lift that whole group up, then you're going to get into a point where you have kind of what the Ducks have had the last 3 years, which is a bunch of young guys who maybe could be good down the line, and then a bunch of good middle six players like Henrique and Silverberg and Raquel, and, you know, and now those guys are basically useless. Like, they're all on 30, they're all on terrible contracts, and it would have made so much more sense for Anaheim to get them out, bring in picks, bring in young players, and give themselves that opportunity to build that second wave. But I, you know, as a GM, I can understand, even if I disagree, the fear that I don't want these guys to be ready and there not be anybody there to help them. And so I think trying to navigate, you know, the window of your core is difficult. I don't think that's an excuse, because I think a lot of teams do a lot of things to shoot themselves in the foot. But I think, you know, like, to your point, it is almost better to just bring these kids in as quickly as possible, figure out what they are, and figure out how they fit in long term, rather than pushing those that conversation off for 3 years. And now you've got a guy who you're bringing in, counting on him to be a contributor, and then you find out he's just not.
Right. Yeah. And quickly, you know, last point I'll make on that is just, you know, you could look at two other sports, and not basketball, but baseball and football, and sort of how they construct the teams in terms of ways to look at that, which is, one, in baseball, you see oftentimes, and 538 had a great article about it a few years ago. I think it's called the Doyle Rule, which is basically trading current wins for future wins. It's like, I'm going to trade, Fernando Tatis at the time, who was a White Sox prospect, for James Shields, who was supposed to get them into the playoff race. And it was a bad trade, obviously, for the White Sox at the time. It was even worse in hindsight. But right. The thought process at least makes sense, where it's like, okay, we are a team, we are maximized equipped now. You know, basically what I tell people to do is, like, in hockey, if you look at war, if you have less than a 20 war team at a current point in time, you're not ready to contend. If you're above that 20 war threshold, then yeah, go all in and try to get current players, because basically all you're doing is maximizing your chances to win the championship in that time period. So you're above 20 war, yeah, go in and start to trade current assets for future ones. And then the other way around, you know, if you're, you know, the Rangers, like I said, being a perfect example, it's hard for them to do because they have so many no trade contracts and no trade clauses and all of that. But if you were able to, I would trade a Kreider, I would trade a Zibanejad and all that stuff like that, because to me, it is more important to get two or three potential contributors that may be as good or at the very least just cheaper than Zibanejad, than keeping Zibanejad around and trying to build around his contract. That's probably not going to be a value later on. So sort of moving on off of those guys who are pricey and expensive and are about to get there, or even for a, you know, for Anaheim, Troy Terry, you know, Sam Steele, Max Jones, moving off of those guys before the rest of the market knows that, you know, they're not going to be the superstars there, and hopefully try to use that as an asset to get another superstar. So if you can trade anybody for a first round pick that's not going to be a starter in the team, then I would absolutely advocate for doing it. The second piece is from the football perspective, you know, one of the biggest advantages in football is the rookie contract for your starting quarterback. If you're having a $30 million a year quarterback like Patrick Mahomes on a $5 million a year contract, will then go all in to build a team around them. They may not be fully at their prime ready to go, but they're going to be at such a value to their actual, you know, dollars that are outlaid for them, that you can go all in on supporting them with other players and then using that to potentially make a run before that next contract hits.
Yeah, this is a rather fraught thing, that I guess, but the Texans are kind of a perfect example of that, because by the time they realized the team around Watson wasn't good enough, now they're paying him, you know, $30 million a year or whatever, and it's like, okay, well, the advantages that you had of knowing that he's this good are all gone, because you've just burned $20 million right off the top because you didn't figure out where you were at sooner. Or you had already hosed yourself with some of these older contracts that put you in a position to where you couldn't maximize his rookie contract.
Right.
So the last thing I want to say, I just want to ask you real quick, is I saw that you had said something about basically teams should be willing to trade four first-round picks for Jack Eichel. And I think one of the things that you mentioned is the fact that those picks, if you get Eichel, are going to be late. Late picks have a very low success rate. And so you're actually getting the maximum return by you're getting a maximum return on those picks by getting one superstar heart-level candidate. Do you think that the real kind of unexplored advantage left in hockey is going all in on trades? I mean, I guess you could say offer sheets, but I wonder if it's more just trades, because then you can kind of negotiate it. Like, do you think trading for young stars and paying through the nose to get them is really the thing that GMs need to be looking at as far as doing to try to build up going forward?
I mean, I think it all depends on the nature of a team. So, for example, the Blackhawks, for example, like them trading for Jack Eichel. The example I used a couple of years ago, I don't know if it's still on Twitter, was saying, you know, if the 2015 Arizona Coyotes traded for 2015 Sidney Crosby, like that will be a horrible trade for the Arizona Coyotes. And people were apoplectic. Like, what do you mean? Sidney Crosby is the best player. I'm like, it does not matter. Like, Sidney Crosby, you know, as I said, 20 war is the threshold to, like, be a contender. So Sidney Crosby moved them from 3 war to 13 war. And they still wouldn't be anywhere close to being a contender, or maybe not even a playoff team, because it does not matter. Like, you need to have a sufficient base level threshold of talent to make it work. Same thing. So going back to the NBA context, the Nets trading every potential draft pick that they could for James Harden matters significantly more than my Chicago Bulls doing it, because James Harden, it may be the difference between them winning one or two more titles in the next 5 years versus those draft picks are likely not going to be that difference maker. And the Bulls are probably trading assets that may equal up to or may exceed the value of James Harden for a return that is likely a second round playoff exit. And so therefore it doesn't make as much sense. And so when it comes to offer sheets, the way that the offer sheet is structured, even at the top end, we're giving up 4 first round picks, because they're treating first round picks as a sort of fixed value. where it's like you're just giving up four first round picks. Those first round picks don't mean as much to the Boston Bruins as they do mean to, you know, a team like the Kings right now or mm-hmm. the Sabres. And so therefore, you should be willing to move off of those picks and say, hey, our window to win is right now. We have the cap space to do it. These assets are likely to turn into the Trent Frazier's of the world. That's not as important to us as getting an asset that puts us over that from a 20 war to 25 war, mm-hmm. which is basically like a 1-in-4 chance of winning the cup. And that's basically all you're asking for. So I think it really depends on the context of it. But yes, for teams that are in that position, you should be offer sheeting every year. You should be. And even more importantly is even if you don't offer sheet explicitly, which I don't think is necessarily the best use of those if you're willing to trade four first round picks, I wouldn't use it on Jack Eichel. I would, you know, split those two first round picks in half, you know, get an Elias Lindholm and then get a, Radek Foska or something like that, or Dennis Guriana from the Dallas Stars.
Right.
Like you can find more value from those four first round picks. Or you can even go to the team that you're trying to offer sheet and just say, like, hey, I would give you these four first round picks for Jack Eichel, and I'm going to give him this ludicrous contract. What we can also do is I can, so you either have to accept it and you run into the Shea Weber situation in Nashville, mm-hmm. or I can give you, you know, three first round picks or two first round picks and this player from my roster and sort of set you back in a far less painful fashion. That you can rebuild, you actually get a player back, and that actually helps us out because we don't blow up our cap sheet trying to overpay for this guy, and we still have some future upside to go with our draft picks. Like, there's some arrangements there. But, yes, teams should be much more aggressive in just saying, like, this is our direction we're picking in. Unfortunately, a lot of NHL GMs get away with, well, we'll just see how it plays out and then get to the trade deadline, and if they're on a 4-game winning streak or a 5-game losing streak, you know, that determines their franchise. And I'm like, how do you get away with that? Like, why is this not planned out from – you should have a contingency plan at the beginning of the season saying if we're 5 games out of a playoff spot by February 1st, we should be trading all of our expiring contracts.
Right.
If we have home ice advantage, you know, by this point, we should be trading, you know, willing to trade these two prospects for that. And that should already be discussed because then that way you can have first mover advantage. Mm-hmm. But teams are playing the waiting game because they don't want to make a quote-unquote bad move, and opportunity cost is not a bad word in the NHL, so you can just get away with not doing that.
Right. Well, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you spending the time. I enjoyed the hell out of this conversation. I hope the listeners really do. Is there anything you want to plug or anywhere you want to tell people to go or anything like that?
I should have something to plug, but I've not spent the time to work on it like I should have the past couple of months. So I'll probably have some trade deadline thoughts on my Twitter account. But my thoughts are that the trade deadline will probably be a bust as it is most years, for the reason that we outlined. People can follow me at Yellow Pinato or look for DJ Bodega Cat on Twitter, and that's basically it.
Oh, thank you again, Chris. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.